Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. My guest today is one of my most fascinating Twitter follows. They are approaching romance writing and publishing from really different angles and putting their voice into conversations that often change my perspective. So I love following them. I'm really, really excited to welcome Georgina Kirsten. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. We already had this conversation where I said, how are you? And it was like, everything is hell. So I don't know why I started that way. But they didn't hear it. So it's all fine. It's new to them. So, well, I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you.
So I was wondering, were you always a big reader?
Yes. I was a delayed reader. I didn't read till like third grade. And so I'm neurodivergent. And so I had like reading issues from a very early age. So I first got like a little brown book, a little golden brown book. You know,
the little golden books?
Those were my first books. And once my teacher gave it to me, because she gave it to me as a Christmas present at the Christmas party, and I was done. That was like that. It was over for me.
Oh, that's so cute. I always loved the Pokey Little Puppy. That one was my favorite. I still remember the Pokey Little Puppy. The golden books were so good. Do they still have them? Because you have kids.
I think they do. I got a few for my kids at like garage sales and at Goodwill, but I think they still sell them somewhere.
Someplace that's open still.
But they were so like, that was the first sort of like, because my parents are not big readers. My relatives are not big readers. So that was my first sort of opening into the world of what reading can give you. And I was done for.
When did you start kind of reading romance? When did you sort of transition into the romance landia?
So my reading was like Babysitter's Club, Anna Green Gables, Charlotte's Web, sort of like very much childish books. And then I think freshman year was my first erotica that I stole from my aunt. because we went to Houston. I'm from San Antonio. I went to Houston to visit my aunt, and she had a hidden stash of erotica. And I stole it, and she was so pissed.
I bet.
And I remember reading it clearly in like detention, like in between my math book.
Oh my god! Like the stereotypical like television where it's like the naughty book stuck in the book. I love that. That's so good.
And I was like, because I had sort of inkling that I was a lesbian, so I would like page through the like heterosexual sex to get to the little bit of lesbian sex that was do like porn, you have a whole bunch of heterosex, then you just throw a bone to maybe the lesbians or the guys who get off to that. So that's what happened. And so that was my first erotica. And then senior year, I stumbled on to a book. It was a Harlequin book. I remember this clearly. I don't remember the name. I just stumbled onto it, and I was just hooked. I was just done. It was everything. So yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of the younger, I mean, I don't know, we didn't call it YA then, but it's YA, right? Like Anne Green Gables and Babysitter's Club and like, I don't know, like Sweet Valley High. All of that I feel like is kind of like romance adjacent. Like Anne Green Gables, she meets Gilbert. They have the enemies to friends, to, lovers kind of relationship. So like, I mean, all of them have those kinds of themes where there's like that little, the little crush, little boyfriend, usually it was boyfriend because there wasn't a whole lot of representation going around in a lot of those books, but like there was that flirtation or that interest that was written into those books. And I feel like for a lot of us, like that was kind of like the path to romance where it's like, I liked the romance parts of Anna Green Gables. I liked the romance parts of Sweet Valley High.
I was more for the adventure. I had a thing back then. Like I was really into Xena. I was really into La Femme Nikita. Oh. I was really into like Resident Evil. I was very much into girls who kick ass, and I am a lesbian, and a lot of lesbians that I know who were in the community, in the Xena community back in the late 90s, early 2000s, were there because we like hot women who kick ass. So yeah. I was there for the, I wasn't even there for the romance. I was there for, you know, women doing event, because, you know, I was very used to, women just sort of being, I grew to have such a hatred, such a, like a, with a fiery passion of damsels in distress. The stereotypical woman who is, you know, on a, tied to a train track and the you know, heroic man has to save her. It drives me crazy. I mean, I used to have rants about Walker, Texas Ranger, and the woman that was constantly in trouble. And, but that's another
story.
She never
figured out how to save herself. Like, you want her
to... I'm like you obviously have this guy who is a karate master, and yet he doesn't teach you any moves. He doesn't give you a stun gun.
We've been watching him, at least, like, pick it up from watching. Which is why I always love, like, Princess Leia. You know, she, like... yanks the gun out of his hand, fires a hole in the thing, goes, get in the, you know, trash suit, flyboy, and then down she goes. And it's like, she sort of is like, look, I'm taking care of this myself, because clearly you are all idiots. So, I mean, and I always love that. Like, that was really cool. And I think you tend to see that more in, you know, like in modern romance, we're writing that a lot more. Would you agree? Like, we're writing a lot more female empowered characters. And I'm really glad that shift has happened, because I think you used to see, even in like the 80s and maybe the early 90s of Harlequin or romance in general, but like more of that, like, and then he came and he saved her. And like, I don't know, I like writing stuff where they save themselves, or where they save him, that's good, or where they save each other. Like, that's what I kind of want.
I used to, because I, senior year and into my early 20s, so I used to shop locally. I don't do that anymore because I can't afford to. But yeah. I used to shop locally at like a book exchange bookshop, and you go in with your books and you exchange them. You maybe get something off, or you get a book free. And so what they would have was these like very early classic Harlequin books. And you know I'm talking about 70s, 80s, you know,
the pastel colors, the sort of like half open, like semi o face, you know, holding her back, you know, like they had a very specific look.
Yeah.
You could have identified them across a room.
So I read them, and these guys are horrible to these women, and they treat them like crap, and you know, I'm like, what is happening? Like, what is happening? So, yeah, I really did love Enemies to Lovers, and I really loved, because I'm an addict to snark. Like, I love good snark. Give me good snark.
Yeah, like, snarky banter is very hot.
Yeah, I write it a lot in my stuff, because I am a snarky person in real life, so it just filters through. But I love when, like, two people just snarking at each other, and then as you get, they get, like, riled up, and the tension just sort of...
Yeah, it's like building.
Yeah. I love that.
But
that's
they're
like
not necessarily
best.
Mean. Like, I don't want Enemies to Lovers where, like, somebody's really picking on somebody else. Like, that doesn't interest me as much. But, like, snarky banter, I don't like you, and you don't like me, but also I like the way you smell, is, like, all about it. I'm all about it.
Yeah, I don't like it when it's too mean. I like it
I
when
yeah,
it's,
I don't
like,
want an
just...
asshole character.
Yeah, I'm, like, and it actually repeats in my fan fiction life, which we'll talk about it later if you want. But, like, I'm reading a lot of Steric right now, which is, like, Teen Wolf, and you get, like, sort of this... Yeah. Hyperactive, sunny personality, and then you get this grumpy, sort of tragic, bronic hero, and then you put them together and let them just duke it out. I love that. And I tend that sort of, these archetypes keeps repeating a lot in both my reading and my writing life, so.
But I think that's, like, the beauty of the archetype, though. You know what I mean? Like, it works because everybody, like, has a thing that they love. Like we love archetypes and characters. We love, like kind of, tropes, and then the reason that they work is because they work, and then it's so fun to flip them on their head or change the way that they work, or, you know, have them be representative of characters that haven't had that trope before, you know. And so, I mean, but the reason that we love it is because if somebody says it's Enemies to Lovers with really snarky dialogue, it's a shorthand way for them to say that is all the catnip that you want, Jess, go press like one button, like one click on it, you know what I mean? I mean, like, it's such an, and then it's so fun to play with, like, how will you play that out? Like, how will you play out Enemies to Lovers? Because you can do it 50 different ways. So it's like, how will that work? And I think that's, like, the fun of kind of playing with those tropes or those archetypes of characters.
Yeah. You said it better than I could.
So when did you start writing? Was that also pretty early, or was that something that came later?
I've been struggling with writing. So I'm dyslexic. Again, I said I was neurodivergent earlier. I have like reading issues. I had reading issues from a very young age. I'm also dyslexic, so things like letters move around. Yeah. Like I can be typing something and something like and then I look at it and then it's just like a jumble of mess, which makes editing uphill battle. So I'm dyslexic. I have ADHD. And then I have, you know, depression and anxiety. So I have like all of this in my brain. And so it was just really hard for me to write and to love writing. And I mean, writing for me was a chore. And every writer has that sort of drive to tell a story. And I would tell a story and it would just be like, what is this on this page? Like, it was just, and I got to a point. Because I started writing in 2002 because I took a creative writing course with my English teacher. And because I didn't want to go through English because I hated English because, again, dyslexia. Right.
It wasn't geared toward helping you succeed, probably. I mean, it wasn't trying to make it easier a lot of the time.
So I took a creative writing course. Her name was Mrs. Bird. And shout out if you're listening, Mrs. Bird. She was my eighth grade English teacher. She actually transferred the same year to my high school, which was across town. And she was half Chinese, half white. She actually reminds me a lot of Courtney Milan, which is why I love her so much. Because they're both half Chinese and half white. And that they sort of have the same sort of personality and humor as well. So she taught me how to write. To take the stories that I've, you know, always had like head cannons and like little stories, and I didn't know what to do with them. And she taught me how to take those stories and put them on a paper. Now, at the time, I was friends with geeks, you know, the D&Ders, people who read Forgotten Realms books, you know, hardcore geeks. And so I brought it back and they're like, oh my God, this is horrible. This is crap. Cause it was just like I remember clearly, it wasn't paragraph breaks. It was just one, like, block of text.
Yeah.
And they just said it was horrible. But I just, from them, and it's funny, now that I see the patterns, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
Teachers have been the people who have pushed me the most, who have sort of guided me on the road. And I will forever be ever grateful. Ironies, and I'm gonna stop talking at some point.
No, I love it.
The teacher that gave me the Golden Brown book was Mrs. Crow. I will remember her name to the day I die. Mrs. Bird was my creative writing teacher.
That's funny.
So yeah.
The birds are encouraging you. All the birds want you to write. That's really funny that they both had the Mrs. Bird and Mrs. Crow. That's really cute. But I mean, that's the thing, right? Is like, if you have the story, but translating it is complicated. Mm-hmm. The story is still there. Mm-hmm. Like the story is still there. It doesn't have a way for you to have it as an outlet. So like having that creating an outlet thing, I mean, it must have just felt like it opened up. It like cracked your brain open because it was like, oh God, here's everything I've been thinking about for the last however many years of my life. If you had always been sort of like thinking of headcanons and being interested in, you know, in story, like actually having that ability to just kind of like put it down must have been pretty meaningful.
Yeah, I was kind of sad because I was never her favorite. It was clearly people who were better and more talented than me in that class. But it's kind of funny that I turned out to try to go professional, or not try because I'm doing it either way. I'm to go professional. And I hope to God she never reads any of my books. I'm a bit perverted. I don't want her to read.
You never know. Mrs. Bird could be all about that. We don't know. I don't know what Mrs. Bird was reading in her book. I'm just saying.
Because I remember her doing these like deep literature books, which the closest I got to literature was like Dickens. I had a thing for Dickens for a while, but like.
Yeah, things that profess to be very, very important.
Yeah.
Books. Yeah. Yeah. So she wasn't really a genre reader then, or that you knew of. Maybe at home she had a stack of romances. We don't know. I'm going to assume that this is true. Speaking of headcanon.
It could be. She was really cool. She was sort of like the cool teacher. She was on the younger side. So yeah, it could be.
I'm gonna assume it's true. I'm just going to make it true in my head. So what is your process? I mean, it sounds like you come at things because this is what always fascinates me about you when I interact with you, when I watch you, is that you seem to be very open to trying new things and to just kind of like saying, screw this path, I'm going my own way. And maybe some of that is by necessity and some of it may just be by design and I don't know how much of it. But like, so what is your actual process when you start to kind of put together a book or a story?
Okay,
like a plotter, so, or pantser, or like, how does that work?
I'm a little bit of both. Yeah. So it took me a long time for me to get to this place where I'm comfortable writing. Where writing wasn't sure, because I had quit writing for about 5 years. I just couldn't do it. It was painful for me and it broke my heart. Like, it legitimately broke my heart. I thought I would never write again. Ugh. And then I started to find my process when I was writing my fan fiction story, which I'm very proud of. And I will pimp to the day I die, which is Plain Hero, which was a trans black Harry Potter.
Oh, nice.
So that's how I developed it through that.
Yeah. So fan fiction was kind of where you started then, really kind of the modern version of you was kind of started in fan fiction.
Yes, okay. Very much so. So. What I do first thing is I like throw it out there. I believe what works for me is that when writing is a collaborative, open process. I don't really care if like I throw out an idea on Twitter and someone steals it and goes, does something else. I come to the conclusion that if someone steals it, that's like my legacy going forward. You know, that's a piece of me into the world and I'm actually flattered by it. So I just throw it out there and I see if there's interest. And it usually is because I like to think about things outside the box. I like to twist ideas. I like, I just like to do that. I like to just not just take an idea that's been done before or a trope. I like to just sort of twist it just a little bit, just, to make it special. And so I throw it out there. And I get like, yeah, and I get Twitter threads of people like, yay. And then I sort of sit down with it and I maybe write out some bullet points as like a brainstorming. And then once I have that done, I'll go and have a seven plot point structure that I use to break it down plot point by plot point so I can get a good overhead view of what's going on.
Those are kind of like major turning points maybe, or major things you have to get to as far as like to advance the romance or the story, I would assume.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
So now you have kind of a skeleton, a structure.
Yeah. It's a map.
That's a better word for it.
It's a map. This usually changes by the time I get to the end of the story, writing that first draft.
Sure.
Because things, once my characters get to a point where they're outlined, think of my characters as like a drawing. Like you do the first sort of like skeleton sketch of, with the figuring.
Right, the circles and the lines.
Yeah.
And very, very base. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I do. I don't tell them anything else. I just have a really rough outline of what they look like. And this could be like 2 or 3 sentences. And then once it's the story, it's the narrative, I know it sounds kooky, but it's them telling me who they are.
Right.
And later on just going, writing it down in like my OneNote and just writing them down.
Yeah. So you're sort of, it's what it sounds like. And it does not sound kooky because this is a very similar path to lots of the people that have been on the show. So you are in very good company, but what it sounds like that you're doing is you're, sort of creating this, roadmap. And then as you go along, the characters are sort of guiding that a little bit. And then you're learning more about the characters and you're sort of fleshing out the characters as you go. Am I understanding that correctly? So you're kind of backfilling character through the story as you go through story. You're sort of understanding the specific characters better.
Yeah. And then I do a blurb. And everybody hates doing the blurb. I hate doing it. It's one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah,
but a blurb is like your mission statement. Mm-hmm. If you get off the road at some point, because I mean, especially doing the edits where you can't stand that manuscript, you can't stand that story to look at it the other day, and you're like, why the hell am I doing this? You go back to the blurb, and right. The blurb will tell you exactly why you're doing this. And yeah. So I use that as a mission statement. I also use the cover. I do the cover. That's like the fourth thing I do in the writing process, because I'm a cover artist. This is what I do. I'm a graphic designer. And so I do visual tokens help me as a motivational tool. So I have the cover, I have the blurb. And when I get lost in the weeds of things, I just go back and I look at those two things. And those are my motivation things.
I really like that idea of it as a mission statement. I mean, I think that we do so often think about that back cover copy or that back cover blurb as just like a horrible, hideous chore that we all have to do, or it's distilling, you know, however many thousands of words into two or three paragraphs, and it's very painful for all of us. But I mean, I really like the idea of it as a mission statement and as a, like a guidepost. I mean, I think that's a really interesting concept. I'm not sure I've ever heard anybody sort of put it in those terms before, but it really makes it seem more exciting. So maybe I'll have to try and think of it that way in the future so I don't hate it as much.
Also, as a tip, because I love giving out tips, I do writing tips on my blog all the time. I do writing tips on Twitter because I just want to make the process a little easier, because I know writing is hard.
Right.
Painfully know that it's hard. The way that I write my blurb is this is why I do the 7-point plot structure thing before I do the blurb, because you can go back and just take up like a sentence from every plot point and put them in the thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I love that.
And do that. Or you could do it like a 3-act structure, which, because I dabbled in screenwriting when I was searching for a better way to write, because I couldn't write prose because I was like, it was painful for me. So when I was dabbling in screenwriting, I learned like just the 3-plot structure and how to do that and how to use that in writing screenplays. So just, you know, break it down in a 3-act structure. If doing 7 is too hard for you, and use that as a guide in your blurb to make your blurb.
Yeah, I do think that that's like such a good idea of kind of having that. I mean, again, I think seeing it as part of the roadmap is a really interesting concept. And I think that that's a really good, super good point. So it sounds like, though, that this is something that this is clearly something when I hear you talk about it, that you have developed over time. Like, this isn't how you were hatched, because you talked about that you sort of stopped for a while because you felt like maybe it wasn't something you could do, and then kind of came back to it. So it sounds like something that's kind of an ever developing, like, how is the best way? What is the best way for me to do this for the way that my brain works? Which I think is a good question that everybody should ask themselves. But it's something that you're kind of always developing, it sounds like.
Yes. Because I talked about this on Twitter, but I'll talk about it here. I, for like a decade, went from medium to medium. And I mean, I went to screenwriting. I went to oral storytelling. I did sort of like pictures, do like sort of like an aesthetic storytelling where you do pictures. I tried every which way to tell a story because I had that compulsion to tell a good story. And it drove me, I could not get away with, I could not drown it out. I could not, you know, do anything to get rid of it. It was still with me. So I actually experimented with storytelling mediums. I recommend this for every new writer, to just take maybe a year, maybe 6 months, and just experiment in the different ways to tell a story, because that's going to enrich your writing. And it totally did mine. So the stuff that I'm talking about that helps me now into developing my story and my writing process, I got from screenwriters. Because I hung out with, like, amateur screenwriters who wrote, like, virtual series, Monster Zero Productions, which they still do. You know, they did, like, virtual Buffy series continuations. And I hung out with the Xena virtual season 8 continuations. So I hung out with screenwriters and I picked up their little things. And the way that I do, because I do series Bibles and I talk about series Bibles all the time, I got that from, like, showrunners who were doing, like, I'm talking about seasons.
Right.
Of virtual series where they would write script after script after script. And I, and they taught me how to build a series and do it episodically. And so, and then I hung out with, like, people who are doing web soaps. And I'm talking about soap operas in written form, and it was release it episodically. So I hung out with so many different types of writers and storytellers. And that is, that's the reason that I'm such a, I am as strong as a writer out of the box as I am now. Because I took the time, that took that time to just experiment.
Yeah, and I think that I think oftentimes writers don't do that because there's so many people who are so quick to say, this is the way to do it and this is the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. And they mean well because that's the way that works for them, right? So they're like, this is the way that I do it. And so this must be the way that everyone does it. And I worry sometimes that that makes some writers stop. They're like, okay, well, this is where I'm the way I'm supposed to do it. And then they try that over and over and over again, thinking it's the only way to do this. And Ooh. It doesn't work with the way that their brain works. And then they get frustrated. You know what I mean? Because the way that, I mean, it, like, there are people that they plot so heavily and they never diverge from the plot. And I've talked to many of them and they write amazing books. There are people that just, like, sit down and, like, I don't know, loosey goosey, whatever happens, happens. You know, there's people that do it sort of in the middle. I do it more in the middle. It sounds like you do it in the middle. There's, and then there's, like, how you write and when you write and the way that you write and where you write and, like, the mediums that are influencing you. And the fact that more people don't just say, look, this is what works for me, but this may not be what works for you, it always kind of stresses me out.
The hill that I die on, and I don't know if you can edit, if you want to edit this out or not, because I know you're a professional writer and you know, best-selling author and all that, which is awesome, by the way. But thanks. Stephen King, I have beef with him. I have the biggest beef. Oh, because of on writing? Yes. Yeah. I have the... And because of his problematic views, but...
Yeah, sure, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, but, like, writing, because everybody, the first thing that like, you ask for, because, you know, you can't always afford to go to a writing workshop.
Yes, it can be very expensive.
Yeah, so you first thing you do is you get a writing book. Yep. Everyone has, like, at least one or two writing manuals. I have a lot.
I have so many. I'm looking at them right now and they're glaring at me.
You know, I did a video of my Kindle library. Nothing but writing books and resources.
Yes, I saw that and I was laughing so hard because I was like, I have that one. I have that one. I have that one. Yeah. And I mean, but again, like, what did he do? He wrote a book where he said, this is how you do it. And all that had to be done was preface it by saying, this is how I do it.
Uh-huh.
And you know what? I mean, like, the way that he does it, let's problematic is separate for just a second because it's not actually separate for me. But, like, it's a fascinating way that he works. And the fact that he could produce work when he was, like, high as a kite is crazy. So, I mean, like, it is really fascinating to read about his process. It is less fascinating to say, if you don't do it this way, then you're a failure.
Yeah, it's that book is the most recommended writing book for new writers. So if you're coming out the box and you get that and you read that, which has happened to me.
Yeah.
It's like, why can I not do this every day? I have ADHD. I'm right. Neurodivergent. Stephen King is neurotypical. There's no way I can mimic his writing process and be okay.
Right, It will hurt you. It will damage you.
Yes. And so he had these writers who were crying. And I mean, I've hung around writers for decades and they're just crying because they cannot duplicate his method. And I've gotten on Nora Roberts about this. I've gotten loudly on Nora Roberts because she, I know I'm going to get some shit from the romance Landia because Nora Roberts is queen of romance Landia.
Well, again, she's like a write every day, and that has really worked for her.
Yes, but she said it in a snotty way. She said, "You can write more books if you stay off Twitter," and I'm like, "What?"
Yeah, right.
What? Like, it just.
But again, I mean, it's that whole thing of, and I think it does come often from a good place, right? Like, maybe not with Stephen King, we'll throw him off, but like, it comes from a place of, this is what works for me, and this is how, and here's the thing, like, yeah, if you can write every day and you can write, you know, 5,000 words a day, you will produce probably more books a year than mm-hmm. someone that can't and that doesn't, and I write very quickly, so I won't say, and I don't believe that they won't be just as good a books as someone that takes 9 months or a year or 2 years to write a book. But everybody has their own way, and I would never try to say, well, Georgina, you have to write my way or else it's not really writing. Like like the mindset of that just is so confusing to me. That like idea that there is only one way. Like, this is not Highlander. There is not only one. Like, we're not going to fight over a sword and then everybody's going to die and one person's going to be the winner. Maybe we will. I don't know. Things are going weirdly, but like, that's not how writing works. You know, I mean, there's that it just isn't. And so, I mean, I think it's really interesting to hear you sort of talk about the way that you have developed that. And I've always really appreciated when in following you that how very much you are open with like, I don't know, if it doesn't work, try something different. Like, why are you beating your head against the wall? And I think it's something that we talk about it a lot actually on this podcast, but I think it's something that always bears repeating is that that everyone's brain doesn't work the same way.
I read a really great self-help book because I cannot afford a therapist, and so I have to do it myself. So I'm always reading self-help books, and there was this great thing that said, question the premise.
Yes.
Always question the premise. Why must you do this? Mm-hmm. Why must you do this in this way? And that has been like, and I've been doing it self-consciously for a while now, but that was like, oh.
Pulling that into the front of your brain and saying, I'm going to mindfully question the premise versus like just kind of subconsciously questioning the premise, I think is brilliant.
Yeah.
Is that from Becca Syme? Because she talks about questioning the premise a lot as well. And she does writing books. I know I saw some of them on your Kindle. So. But yeah, questioning the premise is huge. It's huge.
And I think you go into writing, you go to professional writing, because I knew nothing. I knew nothing about nothing, how this publishing thing worked. I knew nothing. And I sort of thought, you know, I would, because I'm always trying to fit in. I'm always that sort of weird teenage girl I used to be. Rather, yeah. I wasn't a teenage girl because I'm non-binary, but teenage person that used to be who signed up for like cheer squad and in the hopes to like.
Because you're seeking that, like, because everybody says this is where people belong. Is in these six groups. And then when you don't belong in any of those six groups, you're like, I don't know what to do. So you're trying to always cram yourself into the group, because I did the same thing. Not the cheer squad. I was not ever going to be able to do that. But yeah, I mean, it's like, I mean that you're always trying to wedge yourself into a place. I'm tired of wedging. I don't want to wedge.
I thought about it because I have went through so many book ideas, so many whips this year, last year. I mean, I only have one thing that I finished to my name this year, other than playing Hero, which I did in 2018. And I was to a point to where, why is, because I'm still doing this all the time. I even went to a tarot reader, which no shade to tarot readers, because I love tarot readers. I went to a tarot reading because it's like, something is not working. How I'm doing this is not working. And so I thought to myself, okay, so, you know, you do the cover review, you do the blurb reveal, you do the cover reveal, you do, you know, you do the promotion like a year ahead of time, yeah. Or 6 months ahead of time.
It feels like
and
forever.
That's the cycle, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, this cycle doesn't work for me. I am not a person to keep a secret. I like to talk about I get excited for every project in the beginning, especially, and I like to talk about them, and I like to show the covers that I make, because I make every cover for every project, even fan fiction projects. I want to show the cover. I want to show the blurb. Why do I have to sort of wait? What's the purpose of me waiting? And I don't think that.
So you kind of question the premise. So you question the premise on that. Why do I have to wait? People say you have to wait. And then he went, screw it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it the way I want to do it.
Yes. And you can, and I take marketing courses all the time.
Yeah.
I take, because I am a blogger and I've been blogging off and on for 5 years. And I, you know, take marketing courses all the time. And then I did influencing with fashion blogging. So I know marketing. And I'm like, I can still market this book. Even if I reveal the blurb and the cover, whatever you want.
There's
a million ways to do marketing of your book.
Well, and I also think that you curate a kind of audience. Do you know what I mean? So if I write kind of very sexy wallpapery historical romances, which is what I write at the beginning, people that like historical romances will just read it. And there'll be people who are like, I don't want it to be sexy. I don't like this. I don't want it. I want all the details of the War of 1812. I don't like this. But eventually those people sort of fall off. I train the people that are reading me to have an expectation of what I am going to be as a writer, specifically in my stories, and also as an author about how I interact with my readers or how I reveal things or how often I send a newsletter or what's in my newsletter. We all sort of train our readers to have an expectation. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, I like the expect. If you enjoy saying, oh my God, I just got the best idea and I have to tell everyone about it right this second, and that your readership is going to develop to say, I enjoy that. Like if people that are like, well, I don't like it when someone reveals something too early and I can't buy it right away, then those people will just either not look, or they'll be like, oh, right, I'm going to have to wait for however long to get that, or what. I mean, like they'll realize what you're trying to do. So there isn't just one way, because we sort of, there's a billion different kinds of readers whose brains also work differently.
And I write diverse LGBTQ romance and erotica. And I'm going to tell you, as a Black person who is gay, who is non-binary, the representation is minuscule.
Yeah.
I know out on my hand, five or 10 authors who are Black, who are LGBT, who are writing own voices, LGBTQ romance.
Yeah.
And that's real.
Yeah,
and I could talk all day about the biases in, you know, the LGBTQ romance niche, but that's another, you know, podcast. I'll probably do it myself someday. But
we may come back around to that, actually. So we'll hit that in a minute.
Black people in particular, I'm talking from my own experience. Black people are thirsty. They are thirsty to see people who look like them on the cover. This is why I 99.9% always have a Black person on the cover of anything that I do. That was my choice. Because Cole McCade, who is a dear, he's a dear friend of mine, and who I got through, I met through his own struggles by researching his own struggles in the community with Riptide in particular.
Yeah.
Said something that told me something that really pissed me off in his blog post about it. He said, they do not think that Black Indigenous people of color on the cover sells as good as white people. And I was like, absolutely fucking not. I was like, absolutely fucking not. Cause I run on spite, and I was like, absolutely every project I do always have, almost always, unless I can't find that stock image, will always have a Black or a person of color on the fucking cover. And y'all can die mad.
But that's the thing, right? I mean, they love this self-fulfilling, I'm talking more about traditional publishing at this point, but like, it's a circle. They love to talk in a circle. They say, nobody wants to buy a book with a Black person on the cover. That's what they say. Now, maybe not nobody, but we won't sell as well if we put a Black person on the cover. But then they never put any Black people on the cover, so then it doesn't sell, and that proves their point, because they're not doing it. They're like, nobody wants to buy it, but if they don't produce it, then you can't prove whether or not that's true. So it becomes a circular argument.
Oh, and it goes further than that. Because, again, I went into this blind. I didn't know anything about professional, traditional publishing. Or, you know, I... I'm in fan fiction, so fan fiction and romance sort of have a synergy going on, like an overlap going on, because a lot of the, I always say fan fiction is the vanguard of romance, because a lot of the tropes that come from, that go into romance come directly, and I mean paper trail by paper trail, from fan fiction. Mm-hmm. So I was on sort of like the edges of some of the biggest scandals. But as I grow into publishing and I sort of get more knowledge of the professional sphere, what I see is that they are not promoting Black books, books of color, like they're supposed to be doing.
No, absolutely not. They do.
They're not getting, as a cover artist, in particular, because that's my, I can go all day about that. That is my pet peeve. They're giving them shitty covers with like mediocre stock images, some from free sites that's not, and which, you know, amateur, you know, photographers. They're not doing their due diligence in promoting them. Even if they do promote them to like book reviewers, the book reviewers did not decline to review or do book blog tours or do guest posts from books of color. I could talk about how the MM Romance Group in particular on Goodreads shuts down Black readers, Black authors in particular, and that it's very rare to see a Black author being promoted on the MM's LGBTQ or other, the MM, I can't speak today, the MM,
that Goodreads group or whatever they have there.
Yeah, right? The message that's board, the whatever. Biggest solid group of MM readers. If you get in there and you promote your book and you got a good following there, your shit is gold. Damon Swade knew this. Because Damon Swade had tentacles in that group. But let a Black author do what Damon Swade did. A Black person wouldn't have never gotten away with that.
Right.
Or gotten the support.
The gate is higher, like the, you know, it's like, well, this is where the thing you have to hurdle over as an author, a white author, here's the hurdle you have to hurdle over as an author of color, or specifically a Black author, and it's, the hurdle is like much higher, and that has always been true in publishing for sure. And I mean, I do feel like that indie changed things in some ways, but it's certainly not, I mean, it's obviously not where we should be. We're not where we should be.
And the only reason that MM Romance, and I'm going to get pissed people off at Harlequin, sorry, but the only reason we got Karina, the Karina imprint was because of places like the Loose ID and the early Amazon people, because they were making money hand over fist. Exactly.
Yeah.
And they had to sort of like shove that folding chair a little bit in to get in.
Yeah.
But we're still at the fringes. We're still not getting the respect. I can't get romance. There's a friend of mine who got a WD. What's his last name? I'm sorry, WD, if you're listening to this. WD, who got his Black romance into his library. That is rare.
Yeah. I'm sure it took a lot of work. But it's not going to get ordered across the board.
Yes. I can go into my local library, probably find your books there, which are awesome because your books are awesome. It's one of the first few romances I actually did read, by the way.
Oh, thanks. I'm happy they were good. But yes, no. I mean, like, even as an indie, I'm not in the libraries or the bookstores at the level that I was when I was traditionally published. Mm-hmm. However, I'm like, we still get that order. That order still comes, and the order still comes probably much more across the board than for a Black author who's writing romance.
I can't find Black queer romance at my local library. I live in San Antonio, Texas. I can go and find, I can't swing a cat without hitting a white romance in that particular.
Very true.
In that particular library. It's why I don't support libraries. And I respect librarians to hell and high water, but there's no, you know.
Well, it's frustrating if you don't see forward momentum. At some point, it becomes frustrating to...
And people get upset at Amazon, and Amazon is a horrible company. I'm not saying that. But Amazon is the only place where I can pay $10 and I can get my access to Jack Harbin or Jace Ellis or JC Ellis. Christina or Krista Thomason or my people.
Right.
You know?
Right. If the books that you want to read, the representation that you want to see, you're finding that in, I'm assuming you're talking about KU. And you're not going to, and you're not finding it in a library or in on a traditional book stand somewhere, like on a shelf in a Barnes and Noble or an independent bookstore at the rate that it should be.
And the bias against self-published authors, and this is my soapbox, by the way.
Oh yeah, it's huge. I mean, when I left traditional publishing, you would have thought I died. It's the same books. You would have thought that I had died. Like, as far as like going from being included in like best of the year or, getting reviewed in this place or that place, like the books didn't change. I'm still me. But without that machine, like those places just don't remember that you exist. And other authors don't remember that you exist. It becomes a much higher hill to climb. And then you add any kind of diversity onto that and it becomes an even higher hill to climb.
And they did. They did, because I like a good study. They did research recently that the minorities, most of the minorities in romance are self-published authors.
Yeah, I would say that that's probably very true.
And and people often ignore the race element when they're talking about self-publishing, because it is absolutely, some of it is absolutely race motivated.
Well, it cleared the gatekeeping. Like,
yeah.
What, you know what I mean? I mean, you allow that, like, oh, you don't want this kind of book? Well, screw you. I'll just do it anyway. And here is the audience for it. And then you kind of see the reactiveness slowly but surely in traditional publishing, but it's certainly not. And I wonder, because you have a really different kind of author publishing model. And I wonder how much of that has been influenced by that exact thing that we're talking about. Like I mean, I know that you've done serializing and monetizing that way, and you're kind of subverting traditional modes a lot of the time when you're actually putting your work out there in the world. I know you do Patreon. You've got a lot of fingers and a lot of pies that are really interesting. And I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about how you sort of get your work out there, because right now, if you go and you look for your both of your names, right, you're not going to find it on like Amazon, right? Is that correct? Or because I know this year that was the plan, right? And then
yeah, it's not on Amazon. You'll find my AO3 pretty quickly,
right?
But you won't find
in a more traditional Amazon.
I plan to correct that. I actually had plans. I was going to do the Bi Patterson Affair, which was going to be my political romance, because I was inspired by Red Riding Royal Blue, and Red Riding Royal Blue was the first MM diverse romance to ever break the glass ceiling. It was New York Times bestseller list. It is one of the most beloved books now in the MM world, but it blew my mind, because I never thought when I was reading those loose ID books that we could ever break the glass ceiling. And that book showed me that it's possible.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay. So I was going to do Bipartisan Affair as sort of a tribute, but also because I had certain tropes I wanted to see. And then that went by the wayside. And then I did Blood Ride, and that went by the wayside. So I didn't do a lot of things. And I was like, don't do well with, go directly to Amazon, do the book publishing. Again, question the premise. And I thought to myself, well, what if I change it? Because I, again, got my start with fan fiction, which is sort of, which is serialized fiction.
Right.
And then I did, web soaps, which was serialized fiction. And then virtual screenplays, which are serialized fiction. So that's my wheelhouse. And I was like, I can do that. And then I at the same time, I got into the Untamed fandom, which is a Chinese boy love, or rather gay drama. And I realized it came from a book. It was an adaptation of a book. And I was like, let me check out this book. So I go check out the translation of the book, which is online, and I see a Patreon, like, symbol on the next to it. And I'm like, what? And I realize this is a free novel. They're giving it away for free, and it's the most successful queer novel in China.
Yeah.
And it's making money. And the author is successful by all the strata. And I realize that even in self-publishing, there is a weird hierarchy going on.
Sure.
And I'm like, why do... And there's so many great free content writers, from fanfiction to white patterns. Tamara Lush, she did a great episode of a podcast. I'm not going to say the podcast. I don't know if I can say the podcast.
Sure.
Of Chef Love.
Yes. Oh, I love
talking about Wattpad and what Wattpad did for her career. And I was like, I want to do that.
Right.
Because
right.
Again, it circles back. I work well in an open, collaborative process.
Yeah.
I like hearing from my readers. I like publishing from week to week. I can't write any other way because I wrote and got my start in fan fiction. So I was like, why don't I just bring that over here and see if that works?
Yeah.
And then I started reading around and doing my research because I'm a nerd. And I read this book called Freenium. Yeah, Freenium. Which is about the freemium model and how I was so successful. And I was like, I can do that.
Right.
And then I started, because I said, well, I'm going to do it on Wattpad because I did have a Wattpad account. And I was like, I don't like Wattpad because it has its issues with how it penalizes marginalized authors and, you know, the plagiarism thing that they sort of just like do a lackadaisical thing when it comes to plagiarism. And I was like, why can't I do this on my website?
Yeah.
like.
Just do it directly. Skip the middleman.
And also, back to the Untamed novels, which is the Grandmaster of Demonic Cultivation, which is the actual name of that novel. They have a really great sidebar, where it's for you, so you can change the color and the font size and the page size. And that's like, that's exactly what Wattpad does. Why can I not do that?
Yeah.
And then I thought about it because I'm a blogger and that's what I do. And I was like, I can monetize this because fan fiction writers have actually monetized. They're not supposed to because, you know, you don't want to get sued.
Right.
But, you know, they deal Patreon when they do commissions or they have ads on, it used to be back in the day, genocides. Where you had, or genocides, or Weeby, or you would put like a Google ads on the side, or do clickable ads. I know they did that on Tumblr, where they did like AdFly, and donated all the money they got from the AdFly clicks to charity. And I was like,
that's
genius. So I put all of this together in a blender, and I started coming up with my own way to make money. But have free content. And also, I know, scary word, socialist. And I'm like, I believe...
Art for the people.
Yes. And also because if you're a marginalized person, if you're, you know, disabled, if you're a person of color, you are most likely suffering the most right now.
Right.
And you can't go to your library and pick up Jace Ellis's Andre. You just can't do it.
Yeah.
So what other way can you do it? Is it pirating, which is bad. It's bad for the author. It's bad for you. You can possibly go to jail. You know, it's just bad all around. So what's the alternative to pirating? It's just throw that shit out for free. Because that eliminates that.
Well, you open up the accessibility for the reader.
Yes. And so I'm like, this model actually supports what I believe in. But also gives me the ability to be independent and financially independent on my own. And I'm not saying it's going to be easy. It's going to be an uphill battle. But I firmly believe that Black LGBTQ people, because this is my main target people, are thirsty.
Yeah.
I mean, like in a desert, because I am thirsty. I buy every black book that is from a black author and it's LGBTQ.
Right.
Automatically. I don't care. If I see you, I'm getting it. That's all. That's it. It's over.
Right.
I know I'm not the only person.
Yeah.
So there's an audience, but the problem is we don't know where to find it. So we got to do the hard work, and the hard work is like Facebook ads and Twitter ads and blog tours. And, you know, you got to do the hard work of being a salesman and selling this and finding your target audience. But once you find your target audience, once you have a good newsletter going on and you have like 5,000 subscribers of thirsty people who are thirsty for that work and who's willing to support you, because my Twitter peeps have come out the freaking footwork and just said, we want this, and have supported me and is giving me money on Patreon. It was the first time ever, because I was doing art professionally and I didn't get jack on Patreon. But I got, you know, 16 people who are supporting me on Patreon. And that's not much, but it's something.
But it shows you that, I mean, because that's the thing, right? Like, I think that's the other thing is we hear so often about like overnight success. Like, oh, she was an overnight success. We love an overnight success. And the fact is that for most people, that is not their path. Most people do not have overnight success. And so the idea that we aren't building, because what you're talking about is you're saying, screw the model. I want to do this the way that I want to do this because it works better for the way that I work and it works better for my audience and it works better for the kind of art that I want to create. I want to do it the way that I want to do it. And your realistic side says this is going to be, because when you're breaking a wheel and cracking a bunch of eggs and making a cake, which is what you're doing, right? You're like, I don't like this cake. I want to make my own cake. So, mm-hmm. you know, and you have no recipe, right? I mean, you almost have no recipe. You know, the recipe is you want to write a book. You know, the elements of the book, you know, the audience of the book. The book part isn't the cake. That's not the cake. But the way that you're putting it out there, the way that you're deciding to create it is a whole new cake. And mm-hmm. I think it's so cool that you're so open to the cake and that you know that that kind of cake is going to take, I mean, you got to bake the cake. You can't just be like, well, I mixed up the batter, so why is no one eating it? Like that it is going to take, there's so many levels of building out that cake, you know? And so I do think that it's, again, it's like, for such a long time, there was only one way to do this. If you wanted to have any kind of real reach, right? You could write a book and you could publish it traditionally, and that meant you would be in all the bookstores and everyone would be able to buy a copy and your grandma could find a copy, and there weren't a whole lot of alternatives. There were some, but not a lot. And now there's this whole new world opened up because you could do it independently. You could do, and now you're talking about ways that are a whole nother level of new. I mean, some of them, I mean, like Wattpad has been around. That's fine, you know, or the Patreon kind of concept. But what you're talking about is making that the entire, it's not a supplemental that you're talking about. You're talking about that's your path. And I love that. I mean, that was why I wanted to talk to you, because you had started talking about it on Twitter and I was like, oh shit, we got to talk about that.
I'm going to interrupt you.
No, do it.
The thing is, it also leaves you room to do the Amazon thing.
Yes.
Because I do short stories. I've realized recently that I suck at long stories. I can't do 60K. That's just not me.
Right.
I can't do 40 or 30. I'm really good at, I really peak around 10, 12K.
Right.
I can do short stories and then sell them on Amazon. And since, you know, this is the internet age and people got short attention spans anyway,
mm-hmm.
they can just go and just throw that on Amazon and do a bundle.
Yeah. Right, you have 4 or 5 short stories, and you've got like a full length novel that you could make it into a paperback. You could distribute it into bookstores. You could distribute it into libraries if you wanted to. You could do whatever. You know, I mean, you could do both this non traditional thing that you're trying to create. You can make it a tradition. I mean, it's not like picking one path is eliminating the other path.
Yeah,
all the paths are open.
Yes, absolutely, because there's so many. Tamara Lush, I have to go back to her. She's doing it now. I think she just had a new book come out that she did on Wattpad.
Yeah.
And it came out. It's still there on Wattpad.
Right. So the people that want to invest in it in the Wattpad system, they get their thing. And people that want to buy it on that other system get their thing. And everyone wins.
And you know what? People still, you know, because people were like, when the internet was a new thing, they were like, ebooks were a new thing. They were like, oh, people are not going to read, you know, hardbound copies anymore. I don't anymore because I can't read them anymore because of my disabilities and stuff. But Bookgram is full of people posting spines of books they bought.
I mean, there's certainly not as many as I saw in ebook, but I mean, there's still paperbacks going out every month. It's not an insignificant amount of money that I make per year on paperbacks. Is it the majority of my income? No, of course not. But people are still buying paperbacks. People are still buying paperbacks. People are still listening to audio. That's the thing. We have opened up, we cracked the world open. And now I love the fact that you are saying crack it further.
Yeah. Question the premise. Why do we have to do this in this way?
Yeah.
Because if you start thinking about it and you pull and pulling things apart, it's just what I do. You know, critical literary analysis for Shits and Giggles. That's what I do. This is what I'm good at. I've done a year sort of like, you know, taking apart a particular book I won't say the title of, but you know, that's what I'm really good at. So I like taking things apart and seeing how they work and how they don't work and bringing them back together into a new way. I like doing that. So that was a natural progression for me. And what I want in this eventually to do is I'll probably end up writing a book about it because I'm an author, so that's what I do. But also, to inspire people.
Yeah.
To say, hey, if you're struggling with the typical author model, maybe you should, you know, question the premise.
Yeah.
And find out what works. Maybe this part can work. I mean, you can change it and twist it and do it your own way, you know, and that's fine.
Well, not to be afraid of that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Of saying, I don't want this path. I'm going to do my own path. Like, yes, it's always scary to say, well, I'm just, this jungle over here looks like I could totally cut it open with this machete. I'm going to do it. Like, that's horrifying. Maybe, like, that is a terrifying thing. It's not that it's not like staying on a highway versus cutting a new path, but it doesn't mean that you're not going to find something amazing on that path, that path isn't going to work, and that maybe the highway isn't for you. Like, mm-hmm. that both of those things have value is something I think is really cool.
And the thing I always say is that we do our community a disservice when we gatekeep.
Yes.
Because once you explode sort of the paradigm, anything is possible. Anything is possible. The internet is why, because as you're an indie, so you know traditional publishing is afraid of us. It's why they're shutting doors in our face everywhere we go. This is why they're trying to get into Wattpad. This is why they're trying to do this, trying to do that. It's because they're afraid of the powers that indie people have because there are no limits.
Right.
There are no, you could do anything, but you have to say to yourself, is this model, is this way of doing things, productive for me, beneficial to me? And if not, have the courage to say, I'm going to do it a different way. And that's fine.
Well, and that's, I mean, I love that we got to have this conversation because I think you're brilliant. And I really think that, I hope that this is going to be something that people listen to and just go, oh my God, I'm going to question that premise. So I'm so glad that we could talk. I can't believe it, but we're actually out of time. Like our hour has flown by which I knew it would, by the way, because I was like, we're going to do fine together. Because what I would normally say at the end of this is tell everyone where they can find your book, but will you tell everyone where they can find you and read some of these amazing stories on these different paths that you've talked about?
I'm currently doing a new website called Ryan Fox, which is R-I-A-N. fox.com, which is for my erotica. I plan to post my stories on my website, which I also do my blogging, which is writing tips and rants and the monthly tea when I talk about authors who do naughty things. GeorginaKirsten.com. You can also find me on AO3. I think Crave is still on AO3 in its completion. So Crave's on there, Playing Heroes on there. I think it's linked on my website. If it's not, it's linked in my Twitter profile, and you can find it there on my Instagram profile.
Excellent. Thank you again for coming today. This was so much fun. I'm so glad we finally got to talk in sort of person.
I can't wait to hear what you have, what everyone has to say about it. And thank you so much for inviting me.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.